Morning, everyone. Ismail Hussain from the Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Good morning. I'm Michelle O'Connor from Media 24.
Good morning, Honourable Members and Presenters. I'm Lisa Patrick from CSR Solitra.
Good morning, Honourable Members and Presenters. I'm Lena Osborne Madden, the Budget Advisor for the Committee.
Okay, thank you very much.
I'm so used to standing, but I believe I can sit, if that's what I said. So, once again, thank you for the opportunity of presenting the Intellectual Property Rights on Publicly Financed Research and Development Act and the National Intellectual Property Management Office presentation to the Portfolio Committee on Science and Technology. I'm going to cover some background to processes, as well as the rationale for having a National Intellectual Property Management Office and challenges of national systems innovation. I'll then talk a little bit about the National Intellectual Property Management Office, Interim Office, which was created within DST, and some of the impact of the IPR Act to date. And then finally, I'll end with a discussion around the proposed format of NIPMO, and then discussion. Very important, I think, to understand that the IPR Act and NIPMO did not arise from nowhere. There's been a long process starting in 1996 with the Science and Technology White Paper, which I believe was also published in the same year as our national constitution of South Africa. So it's a good year for us to have started this process. In 2000, a technology foresight study took place, and then shortly thereafter, in 2002, the research and development strategy, and then in 2004, the creation of the Department of Science and Technology as a split between the then Departments of Art, Sculpture, Science and Technology. An OECD review took place sort of in 2006-07, where some of the national system of innovation challenges were outlined in the OECD report that was done on South Africa. In the same period or in the same year, a policy document arose, which was intellectual property rights from publicly financed research and development. And in almost the same period of time, in 2007-08, a 10-year innovation plan was produced by the Department of Science and Technology. All of these documents are, of course, available in the government documentation website. In the 10-year innovation plan, DFT set out its understanding of the terminology economy and why we as a country are determined to pursue a knowledge economy strategy, and it also sets out the value in terms of human capital and intellectual capital within that document. And flowing out of the 10-year innovation plan, DST prepared two pieces of legislation, the Technology Innovation Agency Act, which gave rise to the formation of the Technology Innovation Agency, and then the IPR from the Intellectual Property Rights for Publicly Financed Research and Development Act, which is Act number 51 of 2008, which in that act is created the National Intellectual Property Management Office, or NIPMA, of which I am the head. So hopefully that outline of the process today helps to put the whole process in perspective for all of you. This slide is a little bit busy and difficult to read, so please include it for your for reading purposes. But in brief, it does show that the Act came into effect on the 2nd of August 2010, and then was established NIPMO and what's known as the Intellectual Property Fund, which is a fund established in terms of the Act to be managed by NIPMO. So the clauses that are reflected in Section 8 and Section 9 of the Act really just sets out the type of function of NIPMO, as well as what the structure of NIPMO should be. So you can see that NIPMO's main function is to establish offices of technology transfer at institutions, to build capacity development in intellectual property and technology transfer, to provide financial assistance in various formats, and also to establish and manage the intellectual property fund, which in terms of the Act has very specific functions in the national system of innovation. So now I'm going to move on a little bit to the rationale for NIPMO and the challenges faced by the national system of innovation. And I will make the assumption that most of you are familiar with the terminology that I'm using, but of course during the discussion period, you are most welcome to come back and query some of the wording or the interpretation or definitions of any of the terms that I've used in my presentation. Underlying the Act, the IPR Act, and the establishment of NIPMO are broader government concerns with respect to the functioning of the national system of innovation. Government in 2008 invested roughly 1% of GDP, which is 6.4 billion rand, on research and development. And the DST itself has a budget of about 4.5 billion rand, of which approximately 90% is directed to public institutions for research and development purposes. So it's a lot of money to the country, and the problem that arises, and I'll show you some data on this in a minute, is that roughly only 5% of South African patents in the USA and Europe are derived from publicly financed research institutions. And IP is being lost to foreign jurisdictions. So public institutions before the Act had very little accountability for their intellectual property output, and the predominant focus of the research effort has been on research publications underpinned by current R&D incentives from the Department of Higher Education and Training, primarily. Limited utilization and commercialization of research and development output for public benefit has resulted from this strategy. And the underlying or undefined socioeconomic benefits and impacts are of concern to government. This slide again is very busy, but I would like to point out only a few figures on the slide. So I've already mentioned the roughly 6.4 billion rand on that slide, that tiny little box there. And that represents about 30% of total R&D expenditure in the 2008-09 R&D survey, which is also conducted by DST, is 6% of the 21 billion rand that is spent in South Africa on research and development. All of this data is available in public domain, so the figures can be interrogated by members if you so wish. This slide really is a graphic presentation of some of the data from the previous slide, and really is intended to show how government splits its funding into the different sectors. So you can see that the science councils are getting about 15% of government funding, about 2.6 billion. And remember, this data is 2008-09 data, but does keep pace with GDP, and roughly 1% of South Africa's GDP, as I said, is invested in research and development. So these figures do climb annually in line with GDP growth. A non-profit organization says zero, but it's a very small amount. Higher education institutions are getting about 3.2 billion, and government laboratories, direct investment in R&D and government laboratories is about 1 billion, and government business research and development, where there's collaboration between government and business and there's co-funding, is approximately also 50% or 2.5 billion. This slide, the figures are a little bit small, but if you have the hard copy to trade, you can probably see the data a bit more clearly, but I will speak to it. You can see that in 1996, South Africa employed roughly 13,500 full-time academics, and in 2010, that figure has grown to about 16,500 academics. The output from these academics is in 2010, 9,748 accredited subsidy-bearing research publications. And this year, I was at a presentation very recently of the DVCs of research, and that figure is now sitting at about 11,000 for 2011. And you can see the purple line is the master's graduates, and the orange line is the PhD graduates. So about 4,600 master's graduates and about 1,400 PhD graduates. So this is really the primary output of the research system in South Africa. If you look at the subsidies that are associated, I mentioned subsidies as one of the concerns around research and development activities. And you can see about 2.2 billion rand is paid out by the Department of Higher Education and Training in subsidies for the research output. And approximately 1.22 billion of that is going to research output in the form of publication. And approximately 559 million and 461 million for PhD and master's subsidies is being paid to the higher education institutions. So the subsidy system has led to perhaps very good R&D output, but this slide really shows you the growth in R&D output. It's been quite substantial over the last 15 years or so, and in absolute numbers it's gone from about 3,500 up to about 7,000 or 7,500. And of course this date is 2009, and as I mentioned, that figure is now sitting at about 11,000 publication output in 2011. As a percentage of world output, this blue line shows that South Africa's percentage of world ISI accredited output is also growing, although relatively slowly. It's gone from about 0.5% up to about 0.6% of world output. So that is actually a very satisfactory output from the research system. However, if you look at the patenting output by comparison, you will see that in the South African USPTO filing, the figure is declining, it went down, and then at about 2007 it started to climb slightly, which we would like to suggest is possibly one of the outputs of having the IPR Act. With some of the other filings, you can see that there's been a decline in PCT filings. PCT is the White Card World Intellectual Property Organization type of patents that you can file, and you can see the PCT countries are marked in green, and South Africa is a signatory to the PCT Patent Convention Treaty. And if you take out a PCT, then you have 3 years of protection in all these countries that are marked in green, and then you can then file your final patent in any of the countries in which the PCT is active. In the EPO, which is the European Patent Office, you can see that our patenting is relatively level at about 100 or 120 patents, and as a percentage of world output, it's sitting at about 0.1% or so. So by comparison with research outputs and subsidy research outputs, our ability to patent or patent is quite low. And as I mentioned earlier, only about 5% of these international filings are coming from the publicly financed research institutions, which would be your universities and science councils. So that's really part of the problem. If you look at this slide, and this slide is available also from public sources, you can see that South Africa's receipt and payment for royalty on a royalty payment account, you can see that since 1994 there's been a huge increase in the outflows of royalty paid by South Africa to other countries, and the amount that we are receiving is relatively stable at about 50 or so million rand per annum. So if you do a balance of payments, you can see that our trade deficit is about 12 billion rand per annum. So in other words, we are paying other countries for use of their intellectual property far more than what we are earning. And bear in mind the earlier slides that I showed you that show that in spite of our increasing research output, we have a very slow growth in our intellectual property output. And remember, you only earn royalty on some form of intellectual property, whatever that form might be. Like I mentioned right at the beginning of my presentation, the necessity for South Africa to pursue a knowledge economy is generally recognized that economic growth, wealth creation, all of these words that we use on a day-to-day basis in the science system are actually there for a reason, if I can put it that way. So if you look at the balance sheet value of companies, there's been a steady decline internationally in the value on the balance sheet of your major corporations in terms of fixed assets. So land and buildings and machinery and those types of assets has been declining as a percentage of corporate value and has gone around about 80 down to 20% of market value. So if you look at Standard & Poor's 500 index, we will, let's call them the top 500 companies in the world, this has been a trend. And there's been a commensurate or equivalent increase in intangible asset value of corporations over the same period. Now, remember that to measure intangible asset value, you need some way of measuring that, and it's a much more difficult thing to measure than fixed asset value. So if you have a look at this slide on the right here, which is an adaptation of Sullivan's intellectual capital article, you can see that tangible assets are things like structural capital and so on, and intangible assets are your intellectual capital, which is your human capital. So if you don't invest in the development of your people, then you don't develop intellectual intangible asset value. That's why you have to develop human capital. And the other thing you have to develop is these intellectual assets, which are residing in people. And you can see that IP form a subset of intellectual asset capital. And then these intellectual assets, a structural capital, are then used for manufacturing, distribution network, and sales and generation of wealth. So this, I like to show this slide because it's a very simple way of looking at what the knowledge economy is and how you generate value in an economy from a knowledge economy strategy. And it is backed up by research publication. Interesting, this figure here, Nakamura 2003, showed that in the USA, annual investment in intangible assets was approximately equal to investment in physical assets. But, here's the very important thing, the value derived from the intangible investment exceeds that derived from fixed asset investment, and even in traditional industries such as the chemical industry. So it really underpins the need for a knowledge economy strategy in the country. This slide is quite difficult to follow, but I apologize for that. I often get told by people that are too scientists, engineers, and so on, that innovation is not a linear process. And most of the figures that you see of innovation, and I'll show you one in just a minute, tend to be drawn in a linear fashion. What I've tried to do in this slide is to show the interrelationship between the different components in an innovation system, or national innovation system. So it's more of a matrix type of figure. And you can see that in the center, you have some technology creation institutions, which we would call technology push, and you have market needs where people want to do things differently. So if you think of cell phones, for example, why do we need cell phones? So the technology is available, it's actually the market that's creating that demand for that technology. So we call that market pull. Now the relationship between technology push and market pull is really moving from idea creation or invention right through to utilization and commercialization in the market. And to deliver these outcomes, you need various activities. So you need blue skies research, you need the generation of masters and doctorates and research publications, which I've already mentioned, and you need intellectual property, patents, trademarks, industrial design, skilled personnel, and so on. And then you need entrepreneurial activity, entrepreneurs, entrepreneurship, and so on. And you need then to have these outcomes of wealth creation, job creation. So if you look at these two, they do take place in a linear fashion, but they run in parallel. Now, to support these relationships between technology push and market pull and the outcomes, we have what's now generally referred to as a triple helix interrelationship between the universities and fund councils, which are these idea generators, blue sky research, and so on, and government aerospatial type organizations, and your business and civil society. So those two components of the national system of innovation work together. And they work together by providing various infrastructures. So the original thoughts go through a sort of a research facility, laboratory environment, that throws out various things like invention disclosures, which go to the technology transfer offices that I mentioned earlier. Evaluation and selection for protection, and then transfer of that through technology transfer to businesses, because government is not good at creating businesses, but business is good at creating businesses. So we need to transfer this knowledge out of the higher education and science council system into the business area. And all of these activities that are drawn here are supported by resources that come from the NRF, from TRIP, from PIA, and so on, and also from BITMO, and ultimately this block should be there, you know, because this is actually what we're doing all this for, to try to create a better society, so social benefit. So all of this activity is supposed to, at the end of the day, generate those outcomes. So I hope that it's a busy slide, but I'll go into it a little bit here. So what is then BITMO's role within that framework that I've shown you? It's to enable the growth of the knowledge-based economy by encouraging creativity and facilitating the realization of public finance, human ingenuity for the benefit of the people of South Africa. So that very busy slide that I've just showed you, actually we have to capture what we are supposed to do in BITMO and what we think the Act is all about, the Intellectual Property Act. So to get buy-in from all these stakeholders that are illustrated in the previous slide, we want to implement a peer-reviewed rating system to evaluate innovation potential of projects, principal investigative units, and even institutions. So in the same way as the NRF has a rating system, it's possible for an evaluation system to be implemented also on a peer-reviewed basis for innovators. And that means that we could end up with a national innovation index that would allow innovators to be rated not only as researchers but also as innovators. And that would lead to recognition and rewards, alternative career path development and so on, and to meeting the market needs by conversion of these ideas into innovation. efficient use of R&D resources by contributing to public benefit. I've said this a few times, it's really important to emphasize that our purpose for being, not only NIFMA, but the entire R&D system is not just to send a proposal to an international conference, but actually to derive public benefit from all of this activity that's being funded by that 6.5 billion rand of public money. And then strengthening these R&D networks, innovation networks, by building that triple helix relationship that I showed on the earlier slide. This is a linear model that is actually derived from Waikato Link in New Zealand, and you can see that their view has been presented as a linear process of innovation. So going from basic research, idea generation, all the way through to business growth, and then capitalization of these activities from seed funding to startup to early expansion and expansion capital. And where does the money come from? Obviously it comes from industry, from venture capital, it comes from five councils, universities, and TIA. And NIFMA actually also play across this value chain in terms of trying to identify and protect intellectual property derived from state-funded research. All right, another slide. Some of these slides are a little bit busy, but I think it's important that I explain to you how they work. Your research outputs, we let's say, pretty good. Half good would be moderate. Our publication is excellent, as a little, not excellent, good, let's say, in terms of the scale, but I think it's pretty good. And you can see there's the outputs. Our masters have increased over the last 3 years by 46%. Our doctorates have increased by 48%. But you can see that the subsidy system for research publication is actually increased by 54%. So that indicates that the science research system in this country is being driven by the subsidy. And one of the problems is that peer review publications, the subsidy is shared with the researchers that actually publish in most of the institutions, but very few academics get paid for supervising masters or doctoral students, so there's not so much incentive to drive that process. So it's very important to understand that if we want more masters and doctoral students, and remember, they do the research, so the opportunity for IP comes from that research, and the opportunity for innovation coming from that research. So you might be wondering why I'm talking so much about research output, but you can't get intellectual property outputs if you don't have a basis for that, and that comes from the research. So the IP output we think is fairly poor, actually, not very exciting at all. And you can see only 5% of SA IP outputs in the triadic countries, that's USA, Europe, and Japan, is only 5%. I'll show you the data for this one. And our applied output is also poor. So our new products and services and new businesses is just not firing properly in the way that it should be. All right, I'm going to talk a little bit now about NIFMA's response to these challenges in the national system of innovation. And I'll start by showing you the policy environment in which NIFMA has been established. So I already showed you in my first slide the National R&D Strategy, the IP framework and so on. And then there's been this public consultation process going on with numerous meetings held between members of the science system and the Department of Science and Technology and some of the agencies. And this is really just a summary of some of those activities. So it hasn't happened in isolation, it's happening in consultation with all the stakeholders. And we're sitting at this stage now with the establishment of the NIFMA interim office, which took place last year, and which is what I'm reporting to you on. And also the establishment of the specialized service delivery unit, which is what SSDU stands for, which we anticipate will take place from the 1st of April 2013. All right, this again is a slide for leading purposes, but you can see the purpose of the IPR Act is to provide better or more effective utilization of IP, to establish the NIFMA, to establish the Office of Technology and Commerce, and to provide various benefits associated with their work. So IP has to be identified, protected, utilized, and commercialized. So all those activities are activities that are relatively unfamiliar to most of our science councils and universities, and NIFMA's role is to facilitate those activities, so to help funding and also training and human capacity development to ensure that we can do that. We also have to ensure that creativity and ingenuity has to be acknowledged by institutions that they work for and rewarded accordingly, and act makes provision for that. And then SMEs and BBBEEs also have preferential access to the output of this research and protection and utilization. So within the Act, we have to provide for that preferential access. And then I'll just throw in some definitions of what is intellectual property. What is publicly financed R&D? For those of you who do not know this, it's undertaken using any funds allocated by funding agency, but excludes funds allocated for scholarship and bursary. Also, copyright, which is your research publication, is not falling under the Act, but the protected IP that is protected before the publication takes place, because obviously, for those of you who do not know this, if you publish your research finding, you invalidate novelty and then you cannot get a patent after the fact. So you have to do the patenting first and then publishing after that. And then what is the institution? So we work with these 23 higher education institutions or universities and the statutory councils, of which there are 10. And that makes provision for the minister to add to the list. So if the minister decides they want to make ESCOM or one of these institutions, then they would have to do so. So what are the functions of LIPMO? Promotion of the Act, having capacity to consider intellectual property, liaising with recipients, managing information, providing incentives to recipients and IP creators. These can be of a financial or of a non-financial nature. Providing assistance to institutions for establishment of OTTs. Obviously, I think they always wanted money, but it can also involve training, capacity development, and so on. Providing standards and best practices, developing guidelines for IP transactions involving non-SA entities, so foreign entities that deal with our science systems either through collaborative research or other initiatives are also governed under this Act, and monitoring, evaluating, reviewing, reporting, and so on. And then we have an advisory board and a dispute panel to which NIPMA is the secretariat, and as I mentioned earlier, management of the intellectual property fund. So I'll turn now briefly to the structure of the NIPMO interim office. It's divided into three directorates: regulatory and compliance, advisory and support services, and what we call operations and special projects. So the functions of these directorates are monitoring, reviewing, and enforcing of government rights, and also looking at what we call full cost model, because if an industry partner funds a research project as an institution on a full cost basis, then the intellectual property can be owned by that funding partner. If the money of government or the institutions is used in the research, then there are strict rules around who can own the intellectual property. Normally, the intellectual property would be owned by the recipient or the institution that gets the government money for the research. But under certain conditions, if the research is co-funded, then an industry partner can co-own the intellectual property, but as I mentioned, under only specific conditions. Typically, the institution would own intellectual property, and under the Act, there would be a requirement for the institution to then utilize the intellectual property through either licensing it to a company or finding some way of deriving either economic or social benefit. It also mentions, by the way, military benefit or other benefits. So it's up to the institution to determine what those benefits will be. Advisory and support services provide guidelines on options of technology transfer, capacitation, and also helping them to get these disclosures, because without the disclosures you can't protect the intellectual property. And then defining a business strategy around how to utilize that intellectual property. Advisory support also does advocacy and awareness creation of the Act, and what we can call roadshows, going around to all institutions, telling them about the IPR Act and how the institution can get or derive these benefits from government. So how do they get OTT support and capacity development and so on. And then under the operations and special projects, I've highlighted here the management of IP funds, because we are going to change this directorate, you'll see in a later slide. And also running certain special projects, so that's what this is the names of the advisory board members who have been appointed by the minister. Their minister, Honourable Naledi Pandor, actually appointed to the advisory board, and we are yet to have a meeting of the advisory board, which will be set up under the now minister, Honourable Derek Harnacott. So the chair of this advisory board is Professor Tana Pretorius, who's from NISA, and then Professor Gary Atkinson-Hope, Professor Derek Keith, Mr. Stephen Madua, Ms. Nosuba Mareli, Mr. Duncan Rappuskat, Mr. McLean Sabanda, Professor Petra LeBlanche, and Ms. Rosemary Watson. So some of you will know those names, they're all quite familiar to us in this sector. The dispute panel you will see is blank because no one has yet been appointed into the dispute panel, but we hope that we'll get that filled soon. The dispute panel is appointed by the minister, not by NISMA, so I wouldn't want you to see this as something that NISMA hasn't done, but we are still waiting for 5 to 20 members to be appointed by the now minister. This slide shows operating model and instruments at the disposal of NISMA. I'm going to show you, obviously, we have DSU and other departments provide R&D funding and subsidies to the science councils and higher education, and they produce these degrees and publications. They also produce R&D outputs that are disclosed to the offices of technology transfer that I mentioned to you earlier. And they have to then identify, protect, utilize, and commercialize. So the offices, NISMA is not a grand office of technology transfer. NISMA is a facilitator of the creation of these offices of technology transfer. And they provide some incentives. Okay, so you can see we provide, number one, our instrument is providing support to these offices of technology transfer. The protection of IP is not done by NISMA, it's done by the CIPC or Company of Intellectual Property Commission, which is part of the DGI. And you can see IP registration is done in this office here. So going on there, you can see the other instruments at the disposal of NISMA are these incentives. So for invention disclosure, the inventor is supposed to make a disclosure to the technology transfer office, and they can be rewarded for that. And that then is disclosed to NISMA on a certain form called an IP7 form, which is in the regulations to the Act. And the Department of Technology is our line reporting function, and you can see funding and so on is coming from the Department of Science and Technology. Number two would be the IT fund, where funding and technical assistance can be provided to the various players in this space. And then NISMA has a relationship with the public sector and the private sector for the commercialization and support funding of these activities. So, for example, CTIA, FIRE, and such agencies. So, the outcome then would be new product services, new firms, and obviously public benefit, as I mentioned earlier. So this slide really is there to show how the various instruments of NISMA interact with the National System of Innovation. So I'm going to just go through each of these instruments in a little bit more detail. The Office of Technology Transfer has to be staffed by appropriately qualified personnel with interdisciplinary knowledge and expertise. So they're not people that are easily felt. They're very troubled people in our system in South Africa. These tech transfer offices have to develop policies in the institution for which they work. So intellectual property policy, for example, would be developed by the tech transfer office and approved by the executive of the institution for disclosure identification and so on. And the tech transfer office acts as a receiving point then for the disclosure of IP. And they then would go through a process of analyzing the disclosure for IP rights, suitable forms of protection, and developing a international IP business strategy. So which countries are they going to try and commercialize, and which countries are they going to try and attract or interest in further investment in the development of this business opportunity. And then all of this has to be disclosed to NISMA by the Technology Transfer Office. So we have a database based on the IP7 form, and attending to IP transaction and commercialization, conducting evaluation on the scope, as I mentioned, all geographic territories with commercial potential, and liaising and reporting biannually to NIFMA. So it's quite a lot of new things that the institution has to do under the statute. The IP Fund, as I mentioned, is made by NIFMA. It provides financial support to institutions for statutory protection, financing NIFMA's costs as well, and it operates for 2 years under the old Innovation Fund guidelines. And we are, at the moment, implementing new NIFMA guidelines, which differ considerably from old Innovation Fund guidelines. And the claims have to be submitted by 15 November for us to be able to make the transfer payment to these institutions before the end of the government financial year on 31st of March 2013. Another instrument is the so-called incentives, which are to recipients of and their IP creators to reward them for this activity. So we believe that the inventors or the IP creators, and certainly under the Act incentives that have to happen, need to be rewarded for making these discoveries in order to encourage them to do so. Providing assistance to institutions for commercialization of the IP, developing these appropriate policies and procedures for the implementation of the IP Fund, and in accordance with the object of the Act, the operations of the IP Fund, and subject, of course, to availability of funds from National Treasury. Finally, the benefit sharing benefits under the Act are all inventors are entitled to 20% of the revenue accruing to institutions for this 1 million rand of revenue, and as a first call ahead of institutional distribution. So if an institution earns 1 million rand of royalty income from a license, then 200,000 of that has to be paid to the inventor. That's actually a huge benefit, and if you talk to the inventors, it's sufficiently attractive to want them to make this stuff. They then can get 30% of the net revenue thereafter. So anything over 1 million rand, they get 30% of the net revenue after the institution has recovered its cost. And those costs involve things like more R&D operations and set transfer of the statutory protection of IP and so on and so forth. Some of the key challenges of NIFMA are to create awareness. So you remember I mentioned advocacy and awareness. So one of our directors is out there telling people about the Act. There's a lack of entrepreneurial experience for uptake of these disclosures and the intellectual property, but South Africa is still very active trying to build our entrepreneurial culture in our institution. There are conflicting incentive schemes that I've mentioned, for example, the DHET subsidy and also the NRM rating of researchers, and the need for inventor recognition and rewards. Ultimately has to have a degree of independence from DST because of course it will be regulating DST's activities as well in terms of R&D expenditure in institutions that DST supports. Funding of the functions, so having enough money to be able to do all these things that I told you about, having stakeholder buy-in, which is part of this awareness, and having people capacity. We are short in South Africa of these specialized skills for doing technology transfer. Now I'm going to show you some data on NIFMA impact. Very briefly, there's two different institutions. Do they have an existing policy? Some of them are still a little bit behind, and some of them are still under review. Having an office of technology transfer, most of them now have technology transfer offices, or at least access to a regional technology transfer office. You can see that previously, in the, let's say 10 years ago, only two of your traditional universities have technology transfer office and three of the science council. Now, it's a lot better. About 10 have been created as a result of that. And the number of employees, you can see, is growing as well. So there's quite a few that have now more than 5 employees in the technology transfer office. But just to digress slightly from the slide to make it a little bit more interesting for worldview. The Bayh-Dole Act in the United States is the equivalent act of our IPR Act. It's called Bayh-Dole Act, and it's been in place in the United States for more than 30 years now. And most of you will have heard of the Bayh-Dole Act. What a lot of people have not heard of is the so-called Stevenson-Wyder Act, which followed shortly after the Bayh-Dole Act, and in my view gives legs to the Bayh-Dole Act. And the reason I say that is that under the Stevenson Wilder Act, institutions that receive federal funding for research are required to have one OTT professional in their employment for each 200 FDE academics. So it's required by law in the United States to employ one tech transfer office professional for each 200 employees in the PIPE system. They also have a top slice of the federal funding budget of 0.008% under the Stevenson Wilder Act, where tech transfer officers are given money from that top slice mechanism for funding of the technology transfer officers at source. So if NIH, for example, is paying X amount of dollars into the research system at source, they deduct 0.008% of the funding transfer. And that money goes to NIST, which is the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which is the caretaker of that fund. And then the funds get distributed back into the technology transfer office space, and the employees are required by the institution in terms of law. So we don't have that under our own legislation, but I thought I'd mention it to show you how the VAE-DOC Act is actually given there. Some more OTT statistics, just regarding the funding of tech transfer operations by NIPMO. We've been able to get funding in the last year period to announce the institutions. Some of it took place initially under the Innovation Fund, but you may not be aware of this, but the previous Innovation Fund, RBST, was split in a sense into two new functions, the TIA, or the Technology Innovation Agency, under the TIA Act, and the NIPMO, or the National IT Management Office. And some of the functions of the old Innovation Fund went to TIA, and some of them came to NIPMO. So that's why there's some reference made to Innovation Fund on the slide. So this is an indication of the invention disclosures, spin-offs, licensing deals, and some of the revenue that started to be generated. This slide from our Research Fund, the research shows which are the number of institutions, those with the ICT function, those with IT policies, NIPMO's support, current and in village for this financial year that we are now in, and then compliance. And you can see that we're still chasing five institutions to comply with that. This slide, I'm showing you more out of interest than as hard data because this is information that gets disclosed by these five institutions, but it does get you all excited because you can see that from 40 disclosures in 2006 from these five institutions, that's grown fourfold to over 160 disclosures over the period under consideration. And I think that's really a nice indication. We will obviously collect data from all the CTB institutions and publish this in a more formal sense in the future. You can see here the number of South African provisional patents in FIFA climbing. The computer patents granted is also climbing from the same institution. The PCT applications have gone from roughly, let's say, 10 to 20 up to 35, so that's a nice healthy growth in PCT fines. This slide really shows the combined disclosures and then showing the percentage of the ITAR publications over the same period. So you can see in 2006, disclosures as a percentage of subsidized output was less than 1%, and that's grown now to about 2%. So all indicators are actually showing us that the act is starting to have impact on our national system innovation. I'm going to talk very briefly now about the shows you the process that we've been undergoing in establishing that now as a permanent structure in DST, and you can see that there was a status quo review, there was a standard of the National System of Innovation, We did international benchmarking, we did consultations with various other government departments and internal programs and so on. We've now developed a feasibility study which is completed and is in process of being submitted and approved by GST Exco. In fact, I need to correct myself on that. It's already been presented to GST Exco and in process of being finalized and hopefully signed up by the minister. And then we will do some testing on the vitamin information. So just to show you, the feasibility study had to comprise of two parts. An institutional optional assessment, which is what I'm presenting to you now, and a business case, which is derived from that feasibility study. Some of the organizational competencies in the feasibility study that are required are an ability to identify, understand, and do all these processes, to understand the research systems, to analyze and interpret information, to manage and handle intellectual property, to understand the regulation environment of government and to be able to work within this government system, capacity development, to be able to develop people and capacity in the fund system to enable them to handle protection and technology transfer of intellectual property, corporate governance, fund management, and operational management. This is a proposed structure for NIFMIC as an SSDU. Again, regulation, advisory, and support. The IT fund, as I've mentioned, and then some corporate services that will include finance and insurance and human resources. Bear in mind that at the moment these functions are being provided by the DSC, but it looks like I have to provide these services to human resources. LIFMA is primarily an institution involved in as a custodian of IP on behalf of government. It's a regulatory agency, it's an enabling agency, and it's a promotion agency. It is not a policy maker or a registrar, as I mentioned. The SCPC is a registrar of IP, and it's also not implementing commercialization. Either the technology transfer to implement commercialization, or the TIA, for example, is involved in implementing of commercialization. The assessment parameters, governance, accountability, ability to attract, retain, and secure these scarce staff skills, being sufficiently independent of our parents or partners to be able to regulate, ability for intergovernmental relations, intergovernmental department relations, so working with GERCO, for example, in South Africa's international intellectual property agreements with other countries, independent financial management. This is the governance arrangement. Ministry of Science and Technology is obviously led by Minister. Department of Science and Technology and the NIFMA, the Deputy Panel and the Advisory Board. So that just shows you our governance structure. Looking at the implementation of the SSDU, we've already completed this feasibility study, so ticking the box. We're busy developing the protocol and delegation. We will go and present the process in about 6 months from now. Regulatory approval, a lot of these are not sequential, so a lot of these are happening in parallel. And as I said, our deadline for establishment of NIFMA will be the 5th of April 2013. And thank you, Chair, for your indulgence of extra 5 minutes. I'm done.
Well,
it's
near Christmas.
This life, actually, this show has been set up for an great condition. And for those of you who do not know, it's been a highly innovative nation. And it's surprising to see that we are on a path now that's going to lead us towards the knowledge economy and more of these good parts. So I only added this slide just so that people can see how exciting it is to be a South African.
If you go to institutions like CSR, you see a lot of innovation like that. The only problem is that we do not communicate our achievements. We like to communicate the failures rather than the successes. I was recently in England where I met the government advisor scientific advisor for the British government, Professor Clarice. And he did a understanding of South Africa and UK in terms of that he has been a lack of communication between the UK and South Africa, and they now want to formalize it.
Expenditure by force. I'm not quite sure I understand how to read the figures. You've got totals on the bottom and totals on the right. So I'm trying to read here what percentage of RDP is derived by, say, So if you take your horizontal line, if you go down to business, local business, it says 4%. Got four down from the yellow line there now, it's 4%. Then if you go down to the bottom left, and the total business enterprise expenditure is 12 million, or is that in, 12 billion? Is that how I read it? It's correct, is it? So I'm saying total RDP expenditure is 4% for business in this country. Well, that's the first question. I'm just trying to understand that I understand the slide. So that would be 96% is derived.
Where are you?
On that slide, look in the left-hand column. Go down up to local business. On the road, sorry. Yeah. One up. On the left. Right, the heading there, local business. Go to the right-hand side. Right, the other side. 4%. So I'm reading that, I'm saying 4% of total expenditure RDP comes from business. Is that what it says? That's the quantum of the amount. That's 12 billion rand. From business, the way I read it. But I kind of find it very confusing. I'm trying to understand that. But when we get back, maybe you can spend some when we get there. The slide further on 9, we talk about the number of permanent academic staff increasing from 13 to 16,000 from 1996 to 2010. Actually, I think that's quite a poor number, to be honest with you. It's quite striking. It's strikingly low to me. I can see all your research outputs seem to be a nice positive trend. There's a number of positive trends, but the actual number of staff involved in this field, to me, is quite horrifying, actually. I would have expected a sharp increase in that.
I just
think
9,
eh? Because?
Is that 6, 9?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, total permanent academic staff on the right-hand side, increasing. So that's a 14-year period. It's gone up, 50% over 14 years. To be very poor. All right. Then slide 18. I disagree with your assessment of what the figures there. At the top, against research and development, I'm presuming that's the expenditure side. I don't know if it's actually. We've got good against it. Well, I'm not quite sure what you're referring to particularly, but just looking to expenditure in R&D, I wouldn't say it's good at all. We spend less than 1% in fact of our GDP, and our competitors and the peer states are much higher. So I would say we're either poor or moderate if we're referring to expenditure side. And that means we're too optimistic. I wasn't quite sure, these OGPs at the institutions themselves, say slide 21, all the slides in the OGP. I'm not quite sure what is their relationship to the institution? I mean, the institution, if they get set up in an institution, who do they report to? because they develop policies for that institution. So it's not common OTT approach to management of intellectual property. It's per institution, it seems to be a way to prevent it. Who pays the, they pay the salaries of the people that work there, actually, or does it fall under your aegis? I wasn't quite clear about that. I expect that they work for an institution, but what's your evidence? There was a slide, 35, where you spoke about the number of invention disclosures in the past few years, and also the number of startups. And I think it's not too bad. I was just curious whether the startups there have become, are successful startups, and if they have any relationship to the TIA at all, or they have been done entirely in-house, or, you know, has TIA played any role? Put it that way. That's the question. In those startups. And then I've just got some general questions. Your setup at the moment as a kind of office within the department, what is the, what's your envisaged position of the system? Are you meant to be like a separate agency, or do you remain as an office? And then what's not clear at all is just some basic things. How many staff? What's your budget at the moment? What are your specific targets? You show some outputs. Are those outputs of the system as a whole same thing as your output as an office? In other words, do you measure your success by the outputs of the entire innovation system, or do you have specific outputs relating to your function as office? That wasn't clear to me. And the size of this IT fund, it has some sense of that. Then, I can understand this whole thing is designed to deal with publicly owned, publicly generated research, but tell me, I mean, other than we get a collaborative effort with private and government together, where I presume it has a relationship to you. Is there any role here for this entire setup to assist with the private sector in any way? Or any lessons learned institutionally which would assist the further development of private sector patenting and so on? How do you deal with the perverse incentives of the current system where people are encouraged to publish and not patent? Because unless you address that, okay, you have partly addressed it by saying we can give you incentives to the first. But is there any discussion with higher education or with any other role players to change the nature of the incentives they currently offer to be more supportive of a patenting regime rather than a publishing regime? The discrepancy between the number of patents and the number of publications is quite wide. And it strikes me that obviously, it's self-evident, a lot of what one publishes is not patentable material anyway. So the question that does arise, because the graphs were kind of one line here and up here, what it does suggest is that the amount of patentable research that we do is skewed towards non-patentable. And the trend is worsening. So we're doing a lot of stuff in social sciences and a whole lot of areas which cannot generate patents in any event. So how do we, you know, what's the future of that? How do you address that issue? So even though you have a lot of disclosures going up, key to 160, the patent line is not increasing at the same rate they are. The reason why I asked you the other day was that China, last year, had 250,000 roughly patents, and by 2014 will be 1 million as their target. Now we're looking at 120 or 130 or so. I mean, you know, how real is our effort in this exercise of becoming a knowledge economy? Okay, thanks.
Although you didn't mention some, I think you said some B, If you wanted to
have capacity for researching the only way to get money from NLF is the number of publications. And then they will say that, no, they do not understand what SMP is required of them when this side, the people who are supposed to fund the site, they have another priority. They want publication to let them treat it. So I want you to hear what you're going to say there. Thank you very much.
If there's an overlap, I'll try and deal with more than one question in the same time. I'll start with your list of questions. I agree with you that page 8 is very confusing. The data comes from the National Research and Development Survey. And to gain understanding of that data, one really needs to read the survey, which is several hundred pages. So what I was trying to illustrate with that table was the significant contribution made by government to the research costs of the country. And the table also shows its action between government investment in research and development and a very important industry investment. What is not shown on that table, which is perhaps very worrying, is that at least more, in fact more than the 12 billion indicated on that table that is invested in South Africa by industry is being invested offshore by industry in research and development. At least, I think it's about 18 billion, and I can be correct on that, but significant amounts of money are being spent by industry outside of South Africa on research and development.
By our industry?
Our industry. Of spending almost the total amount of our national R&D budget is being spent outside of South Africa by industry. So it's a significant factor that should be seen in that context, and my view is that they may spend more of that money in South Africa if we had a more innovation-focused R&D strategy. In terms of the actual readings on the table, it's very difficult to respond to that without having the whole document in front of me. The question of permanent academics, obviously, is the Department of Higher Education training output, not a DST output. And I would concur with honourable members that it's not a very encouraging thing, because if you consider the massification of students in South African higher education institutions, What's actually happening is that academics are being used as teachers and not as researchers to cope with the increased number of students in the institution. So the impact of these low numbers of academics is having a negative impact on research output, because the academics are spending all their time teaching instead of doing a balanced workload of teaching, research, and community engagement, which is really what they're supposed to be doing. If you look at the question of R&D expenditure, it is just less than 1%. I think the current figure that's being used or cited both by government and internationally is 0.92% of GDP, but it is the state's intent of government to move that figure up well beyond the 1%. Why it's shown in my data as good is as much to do with trying to encourage researchers as to do with the actual sum of figures. It depends on one's perspective, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. So I think that if we are spending almost 1% of GDP on research and the trend is up and we're going to be spending more money on research, I would see that as an encouraging figure. It may not be as high as some of the first world countries. It is, in terms of ranking, it's about in the middle in terms of the countries that we compare ourselves with. It's not bad, but it's also not as good as it could be.
But I'll differ with you, because actually, in order to get the increase, you must show our values, so that the government should see that we need do something about it. Now when you say you're already right, then you're making me tell it, oh, but this guy's already right. So why should you work?
I don't disagree with you. I think it relates to what I was saying earlier. If we can leverage off government funding to attract our own industries to spend more of their R&D money in South Africa, then the 1% of GDP would be generating a far better research outcome. Also, a lot of our industry research that is conducted inside the universities is of a very limited nature. So it would be better, I think, to encourage industry to spend more of its R&D funding in South Africa, rather than, let's say, creating more dependency on government for research funding. That would be my personal point of view. And of course, Dr. Mulani might want to say something different. But I personally would prefer to see South Africa becoming, its research system becoming more dependent on industry participation in research, rather than just spending more government money on research and expecting a different outcome.
Yeah, because, for instance, it would be very difficult. We have a strategy in this plan to increase more manufacturing industry. And in doing so, we need a lot of kind of what is a great innovation, for instance, get to countries that are already at a certain level and try to take what is possible and develop our imagination of research capacity. So now without and without developing the research capacity in terms of funding, it will be difficult to do all of this because we know they have the capability. David, did you want to say something?
Yeah, thanks. I'm trying to indicate that particular slide that in terms of how we spent the money that we put in terms of R&D investment, we did relatively well. But in terms of whether the actual investment itself is adequate, I think that's another issue altogether, because what we are saying is not enough. But if you want to move innovation from where it is at the moment, a little higher to a bigger, you need significantly more investment. And I'll give you an example. If you take the NRF, its current budget is over R1 billion. If you take the IEC, it's several billion. But if you take the TIA, it's a $500 million. You have the innovation capital, you have to get across in terms of taking R&D output into the commercial market. The funding instruments in these entities are also, mapping onto it's kind of exacerbating the challenge as well. So you have to have significant levels of funding coming through as well to support innovation to make it bigger as well. And this is where we look at above 1%, where you could look at 1.5%.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, the trouble with that 1% target is we've never met it yet, ever. And we're not increasing, because I think it was 9.92 now, 0.96 last year, about 0.95. I mean, it's been flat for the last decade. And we set ourselves a target now of 1.5%, and we've got across 1. So I think it's a real challenge there, and a major issue to be addressed. And this issue you raised of $18 billion being spent by the African government, and the person business abroad on R&D, the figure I've never heard before, I find it quite astonishing. I'd love if we had time share to interrogate that sometime.
Can I add one more comment in terms of the slide that's on the screen? It clearly indicates that a lot of money is leaving the country for work and for technology perhaps that could be developed locally. And it's not a nice job to direct a research system in this country, but it is a role that we can play in terms of interpreting the data and trying to influence the national system of innovation towards more positive outcomes for our society. So we could understand this upflow of capital. Clearly it's got a starting point and it's accelerating. So we need to understand why we are paying royalties to foreign entities and whether some research could be done that would generate income rather than expenditure. So I think that's why I've actually illustrated to a certain extent the discussion that we have been having.
Just to add to that as well, there was an innovation survey that was done recently, and one of the questions that was posed was to industry is in terms of where they look for their ideas, and less than 1% actually look at the universities. And this slide is kind of
scientists in terms of how this can happen. So that the more people come to science, and not the more they increase in their research output, the more we will starting to allow or putting more funds, but the world is struggling in terms of the TPP. I don't know, I can't remember the experience, something like that. Maybe you can explain it.
You know, my interpretation is that government spends a certain amount of money on research. Industry always look at where they get best value. So if you look at this slide, it shows that industry sees more value in foreign-generated research than South African research. So what I've been trying to indicate is that we feel that it's not good enough to just throw more money at the problem. One has to try and understand the drivers of the system and how one can develop a strategy for trying to attract South African industry to do more home-developed research. And that means the national system of research, the universities, the science council, have to show greater value to industry. So why would they go offshore for that research when they could do it here if they were able to access the right kind of research? The problem, as I mentioned, is that our scientists are being used as teachers instead of researchers, because we've got this application going on in the universities where you can teach a class of 200 students and then you must set exam papers for them and mark them and so on. So if you talk to any academic in the system, they will tell you we just got too much of a teaching load, so we can't do research. And of course, if industry comes to them and says, can you participate in research, they don't have time for that.
And then it comes back to the question that I said, that actually, the academics, they do more of their research for consultation purposes rather than professional purposes, which then doesn't attract the industry. You see, and exactly that is what they were saying. So unless the U.S. Department finds a certain mechanism in which to sort out this balance in terms of the demand for publications for their funding, that's the PTC. And that's what it's going to be. Industry is attracting the government to publication. So the balance is exactly there, and they are saying, because they have appealed to us as a committee, that you see, can you find a way that the Department of Science and Technology, in terms of NRF, for us to get funded, if they can balance this thing, then it would be better for us to use the medical. Because when you see that a patient takes a pass of them to give it, there is no funding from another, and therefore collapse. I think that's what it really is, the whole thing is like.
Thanks, Chairman. The problem is that it's a difference of culture between the private and public sector, where one wants to publish and the other ones want to protect the money. And I think Professor Anderson has mentioned a director question also asked in terms of the incentive schemes and how they exacerbate the problem. Because some of the indicators for some of the entities put out there in terms of publications and post-recent publications and so on. So I think this, and one of the things we are working in the department is to develop what's called a commercialization framework to accelerate commercialization. And these are the kinds of issues we'll be looking at.
Well,
which
I think we should not exclude what we call innovation management framework.
Everyone, that was the next question. The question was around OTTs and the establishment of these institutions. Under the IPR Act, all of the 33 public finance research institutions are required to have an OTT or to participate in a regional OTT, which can be established by a number of institutions. And I showed that some of the institutions are not yet at that position, but they're moving in that direction. The OTT itself provides people and expertise to assist the institution or the group of institutions to provide those services to the whole institution. So all researchers working in a particular particular institution should have access to the expertise that's in that office.
And the employer is the university.
The employer is the university. Although some of the funding for the costs of employment are currently and in the future will also be provided by NIPSC. So we don't expect that they will get all of the money from government, but they certainly can apply for some of them. Under that, we're not doing favours, we're just following what it says in legislation. In terms of the startups that we indicated on some of the data, TIA presently funds something in the region of 100 projects, and you can see the number of potential startups is much more than that. So TIA choose, they pick the projects that they wish to invest in, but the universities have every right and ought to involve themselves in their own startup strategy. So there's no reason why a university or a science council cannot be engaged in a startup strategy that involves many hundreds of different projects. So the data that we've shown there is the startups disclosed to us by the institutions, not by TIA. So it's, without having actually the list of startups in front of me, I can't tell you which of them are funded by TIA. But it's a very good question. I think we should be asking ourselves that question to see whether we are, let's say, facilitating growth of TIA's innovation strategy through the activities of NIPMA. It's an indicator I hadn't thought of before your question, but I do think it's a very good question. The question around agency, what type of agency? The SSEU is a specific type of agency in government. I understand that this will be the first SSEU established in government by any government department. So it is something provided for in the government legislation, but it's not the same as a government component. It's very slightly from government component, which is a new government speak for agency. So a typical government agency is now called a government component, and the difference really is that the SSEU remains as an office within a government department, and the employees of the agency, or in this case SSEU, will be directly on the Department of Science and Technology payroll as opposed to being an independent agency. So it's a closer relationship with the government department, slightly closer. It may end up that NIPMA become a public, an independent public entity at some point in the future, but under the current economic climate in South Africa, we have been led to understand that National Treasury are not really supportive of the creation of new public entities at this stage. So we are of the view and the advice that we've received from the National Treasury has an advisory body called Technical Assistance Unit, or DAU, which has been advising us in development of the strategy, and they have advised us to go on the SSEU route because it's less likely to meet any objections from National Treasury. The question around staffing and budget, we currently have 19 staff members, of whom 11 are on the establishment, and will be the core of our staff in the new SSEU. Our final staff complement is going to be in the region of under 30, but we have to apply for each post independently. So we'll start with the 11. The other 8 people are on short-term contracts, 6 months or less, or are intern. So we are using the internship program of the various DSC, NRF, and Innovation Hub, because we are located in Innovation Hub, to provide us with the additional staff that we require. In terms of our budget, we have submitted a three-year NTEF budget to DSC, which has been included in the current NTEF cycle from the 1st of April 2013 for the next 3 years. So that NTEF cycle is underway, so we still don't know whether our budget has been accepted by National Treasury, but it has been accepted by DST. Our expenditure in our first year of operation was 55 million, and our budget for this year is just, I think, on about 70 million. Mm-hmm. And we get our money from Program 2 in the department. Everyone here on the, if I haven't given you enough, let's just tell me. Our specific target, we have to date had three strategic planning sessions in which we set a vision, mission, and strategic objective for NIPMA. I have not presented that as part of this portfolio committee presentation, but of course we do have strategic targets, and our strategic targets feed into Program 2's strategic target, which then form part of the DST's strategic target. And we have set specific numbers of people trained, people employed in the OTT system, etc. And to all my knowledge, we've met all our targets today. We are not behind in terms of any of our targets that have been agreed by Program 2 or the DST itself. But I try to present a different type of presentation to the group. In terms of the IT fund, I think that in the past year, we transferred in the region of 20 million rand to the institution for IT support. We pay in the region of 50% of the direct, what are called patent prosecution costs. That doesn't mean you go to court, but you file a patent or you renew a patent, and there are costs associated with doing that, and those are called patent prosecution costs. So the roughly 20 million of transfer payment in our budget of 55, that's in the past year, indicates that the institution claimed a total of 40 million from NIPMA, and we reimbursed them 50% of that. And we do anticipate, from the slides I've shown you, a marked increase in that expenditure over time. So the IT fund at the moment is a fledgling fund, if I can call it that, which we do anticipate a significant growth over the years to come. The challenge for us as NIPMA is to establish indicators that demonstrate value to society. So it's no use just giving more and more money to patients, because if the patients are not going to be used in industry and for the benefit of society, then you're just wasting money. So you're building a huge portfolio of patents that have no value. So our challenge at NIPMA has been to determine indicators that will drive the outcomes of the ICR Act as has been outlined in the Act. So we need to link social benefit back to the strategy and be able to have indicators that show that if the IT fund is growing, then so is the economy. So those are the links that we've tried to create there. In terms of funding to assist the private sector, it's not the first time we've been asked that question. It is not part of the IPR Act. However, I do believe that it's a very important aspect of IT fund activities. And in time, we've only been operating for 18 months as an interim office. So when I say in time, I mean in the near term, let's say the 6 to 18 month time frame, we would like to develop a strategy whereby our support for IP that is being commercialized in industry can actually generate benefits not only to the inventor, the institution, but also to the industries that are taking the risk to establish the spin-off and to drive the national system of innovation. It's not clear to me right now how we're going to do that, but certainly I think it's something that also bears merit in further investigation. The question of perverse incentives, Dr. Muntami has responded to that. Early on we identified this as a problem, but I had indicated in one of the slides here, the one where I showed the NIPMA vision, is to implement a peer-reviewed rating system of evaluation for innovation potential. So if you look at the rating system within the NRF, it does certainly drive academics to publish because it improves their rating. And the rating, NRF funding is not good. Let's put that back. Low in terms of cost of doing business. I want to work out that the average NRF drop is approximately 50% of the employment cost of research assistant. So it's really not a lot. It doesn't even pay for one research assistant. However, the academics like the rating system because it gives them standing in the international and local research community. To be an A-rated researcher of the NRF in itself has great value to the academics, even if the monetary benefit is not so great. However, the Department of Higher Education and Training subsidy is substantial. And I've shown you it's about two and a quarter billion rand among the institutions that benefit from it. One thing I did not show is that 65% of that 2.25 billion rand goes to the so-called Big Six. So six institutions get 65% of that money because they produce most of the research output. So there's two perverse incentives. The one is the subsidy from DHET. The other is the rating system of NRF. And in between that incentive process, we have to find ways of incentivizing researchers to disclose their inventions and for universities to invest in the development of those inventions.
Jasper, on that one, I think the question was not so much, to understand it, the question was whether, in addition to what you're doing to incentivize the payment system, there are incentives being taken for the other two processes to moderate in some way the effect of their incentivization so there's more line between the objective of what we're trying to achieve the whole. Is the question that we're left with two systems of incentives and the researcher can choose A or B, or is the question that we have one system where the research output is, you know, the emphasis on the level is decreased while the emphasis on the other is increased? I mean, which of those two are we heading, or do you think we're going to head towards?
Very difficult question. It sounds like Dr. Masami wants to respond to this.
I think more that we could look at more the latter in terms of two separate and single kind of the box. What you want to do is to create a competitive system, because you want a system where the collaboration is being done more than the latter. But that is exactly what what you must dedicate yourself to now is to find the critical index which does not create competition between the two systems and which does not encourage incentivization of one against the other.
That comment is is an excellent introduction to the next question, which is about patentable research versus other research. And it is true to say that patentable research is sometimes more difficult than just other research. So if your intention is to pursue the government funding for publication, then you may publish a paper which is not a challenge in this case, than one that requires patenting. So I think there might be a tendency among certain researchers to take the easier route. However, I think the indication that I've given on the previous graph on the balance of payments on the work account is a clear indication that there are opportunities in that field that need to be identified by the research community and pursued. And because there's so much money involved in it, 12 billion rand involved in that, and then the other 18 billion of foreign research that's being conducted by local companies, you're looking at 30 billion rand of potential income that could be generated within the research community. And I don't think it's NIPMO's role to identify that. I think all researchers should be trying to find out where there are gaps in the system for themselves to conduct research. So I do believe there's masses of patentable research opportunity to be had. the question of conversion of research to patents and technology transfer is really the domain of NIPMA, and it's the area that we will be pursuing over time and creating mechanisms which allow institutions to be more successful in determining what research can be protected and what strategies exist for licensing or assignment or whatever of the research. But it's a difficult question to answer because it's so broad, it covers almost all of NIPMA's mandate. I don't know if you have a more specific question in mind, but that was how I understood the question. I'll move on to the next one, which Nkosi asked. It's to do with the indigenous knowledge system research. WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, to which South Africa is signatory, has in fact established a unit within WIPO that is looking specifically at indigenous knowledge research systems from a patentability and protection point of view. So I must understand that you can only patent something that has never been disclosed in the public domain before. So the challenge for indigenous knowledge systems is that most of your knowledge has been in the public domain for a very long time. So it cannot be patented. The challenge for WIPO and for South Africa is actually to define what is in the public domain and what is not in the public domain. So if the knowledge, the indigenous knowledge, is in the public domain, is then used by WIPO in the PCT system, and we obviously as a signatory follow suit, we then have to exclude it from patentability because it's in the public domain. That's the definition of patentability. So it's only knowledge, indigenous knowledge, that's not in the public domain that can be protected through the normal patenting system. I think the value to indigenous communities of intellectual property is to create relationships with the research sector that would allow discovery of new inventions through a collaboration between the research sector and the indigenous communities that have that knowledge. That's the only way that I can respond to that. It is within the DST a IKS office, similar to NIPMA, headed by Professor Jonas Salati, whose unit is there to, let's say, inform, advise, and communicate all options and possibilities around indigenous knowledge systems to the science community. And I don't know if Dr. Mbombi would like to mix up here.
If I can add, there's two program two, that relates to IKS and kind of some effect on IKS. The one is the IP issues, and the other one is biotechnology. And as you know, in sort of bioperspective, the hit rate with regards to IKS is much more, much greater than with the conventional, where it's 1 in 15,000 or 1 in 20,000. Whereas the IKS, you probably get 1 in 10, 1 in 20, hit rate, so successful hit rate. So what we're trying to do to undertake some kind of a realignment in the DST, where we want to bring the IKS in relation to biotech and health program to ensure that IP issues are dealt with by NIPMA. Because what we don't want in the department is to lower points to WIPO dealing with IP issues, one is dealing with IKS, and NIPMA dealing with everything else. We want to compose it. Because NIPMA has IP specialists, they have patent attorneys and are dealing with all these issues that need to be done. So we want to ensure that, that we deal with this in an optimal fashion. Thank you.
Sui generis.
What?
Sui generis.
Yeah, sui generis, yeah, yeah. So, I think these are all the things that really are very important and they need to attention as we develop this work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
In dealing with the second part of that question, the question of are indigenous people benefiting, are there social benefits and the leakage of intellectual property from South Africa? I think we all know that intellectual property has been leaking from South Africa for the last 300 years.
Mm.
And one of the reasons for the bringing into being of this act is to try and, let's say, control the leakage of intellectual property from the country, or at least to ensure that there is social benefit and economic benefit to South Africa from IP that it generates. And whether that be in the formal science, the research sector, or in communities, or in indigenous groups or groupings, I think that the intent of government is to address that issue at its very many various levels.
To work with us in developing this IP to help us, for the time we may propose that to our colleagues.
We are with JICO, JICO, which is the equivalent of the EPO or USPCO, have been joining with us. But like all countries, they have certain agendas and things that they want to keep for themselves. So we need to always try and negotiate a course in terms of our requirements and not only satisfying theirs. The challenge of incentives benefits to indigenous knowledge systems is, to a certain extent, being looked at in DST by NICRA, but also by WIPA, and we are very interested to participate in international, because South Africa is not the only country in the world that has indigenous knowledge systems. There are other communities around the world that have well-developed indigenous knowledge systems. And I think that by collectively working together on these challenges and finding ways to incentivize communities to participate in the formal private sector is something that we are definitely interested in playing a part of. And we'll, in time, see how these things unfold, these challenges. I don't have a lot of answers right now for how we should do it. Can I move to Honourable Plunkey's question? The question of literal accountability is a historical thing, that's a trend, let's say, in higher education worldwide. So the way in which higher education was conducted over the past few centuries has been sort of a philosophy model, where you sit under an olive tree and you contemplate the stars and the world and the meaning of life and such wonderful questions. The modern understanding of universities is far more grounded in the needs of society. And I think that what we are seeing now is a worldwide trend towards greater accountability for research, especially research that's conducted with public money, so that society does derive a benefit. So the question is that there is going to be a need for more accountability, and that's why there's a need for legislation of this type. The question of balance of payments on the royalty account, I think we've responded to in the previous discussion. The chair's question around GDP, I think we've already responded to that. The IKS question we've responded to, and the patenting it's a patent system as it relates to the IKS system is something we've already responded to. And we've also responded to the NRF recognition and reward system and the unintended consequences of that for the NRF. So I hope that you've answered all the questions, Chair.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your presentation and for the enlightenment on the topic. When is the legislation to finalize the supplement?
Chair, I don't think the legislative matter is the process. So I just have one slide where so you will see from this slide that we have completed the feasibility study. The protocols and regulations and the service level agreements with DST are currently under development. We have presented the feasibility study to the DST executive and it's been approved. So the process now is that we need to present it to the minister for approval. And we will then get a gazette notice. And as I said, we've already done our 3-year MTF submission to DST, which I think has already gone through to Treasury. And we will know shortly whether we've got our budget. And I think that, as I mentioned, our target kick-off date, or the formal date for the establishment of the SATU, is the 1st of April 2013. And our people will be appointed also in that same time period in our budget. So I think that all systems are on track for the establishment of NIPMA as a SATU within the DST from the 1st of April 2013.
Okay. Just arising from that, that would suggest you look at point 6. Are you then the acting head, or are you the head?
I'm the head.
The head still to be appointed.
I'm the head of the NIPMA as an interim officer.
Oh, as an interim officer.
It is an interim officer at the moment.
Is that a formal statement?
I wasn't appointed as an acting head, I was appointed as a head.
So there's a capital I, it's a small I of interim, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, capital
intro. I don't know if I'm going to be the head of that. Maybe you
can
put in a good word.
No, no, no. The separation of the two, which one was two. Not quite good
for me. Me neither.
Oh.
Okay, thank you very much. I think members have interacted with you. We are looking forward to thank you very much. We will then interact in due course. It tells us when the meet arrives. But thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to present you this update. And if there's any more questions, clarifications for this.
And not just with us, with his contact address and the details. Just give them to show us. Okay, thank you. I think that's the last session.
Yeah, you too,
Oh, cool.
Thanks, man.
Could I do that to the